Hello and welcome to the Technically Legal Podcast. This is episode 109 for Tuesday, July 12th, 2011. I'm David O'Brien.
And I'm Dominic Rabier.
And Ben is being a good friend and helping someone move this weekend, so he won't be on the show. But we do have two great stories to talk about this week. First, a group of major ISPs and content owners have entered into an agreement about copyright infringers. And next, an opinion has been issued in the Apple versus Amazon trademark infringement lawsuit over the App Store mark. So, let's go ahead and get started. This week, major internet service providers Comcast, AT&T, Verizon, and Time Warner entered into an agreement with the RIAA and the MPAA to voluntarily help crack down on copyright infringers outside of the court system. Kind of in sum here, ISPs will give their subscribers 4 to 6 chances to reform their infringing ways before throttling or limiting service. According to the agreement, when content owners like UMG, Sony, or Disney determine that an IP address is infringing their copyrights, they can notify the ISP who issued that IP address that they believe one of the subscribers is infringing content. Then the ISP will set sort of the system of steps in order, these 4 to 6 steps. It's worth noting that there's a lot of overlap between the steps, but the first time that an IP address is identified by a content owner to have engaged in infringing activities, the ISP will first contact the subscriber and tell them that someone may be using their account to infringe copyrights, and that such activity is unlawful. Also included in this message is information about copyrights and why it's important to respect the rights of content owners, also some information about how to secure a wireless access point and how to talk to your kids. On the second time that an IP address is identified as engaging in infringing activities, the ISP may but does not actually have to send a second notice that is pretty much identical to the first one. The ISPs can go right on to the third step if they want to, and that is on the third occasion that the address is flagged, the ISP will then provide a notification actually through their services that they're offering, the internet services, that the subscribers are actually required to acknowledge. It sort of looks like, according to the agreement, they use the phrase pop-up. Not really sure what that would look like, but it sounds like there would be some sort of click-through agreement in order to get the required consent or assent that the subscriber acknowledges that they have received this notice, that this is the third time that you have notified that your account has been associated with copyright infringing activities. I think the gist of it is that the subscriber has to be made aware that this is the third notice of infringement, and again, the subscriber has to be reminded that there will be consequences for violating the ISP's policies and the copyrights of others. On the fourth notice, it functions a lot like the second notice. Basically, it's just another iteration of the third notice, where again, the subscriber will be required to click through some sort of notification that says, "Hey, this is the fourth time that we received a notice that your account has been engaging in copyright infringing activity, and you have to click through it." At the point of the fifth notice, things really start to get punitive. According to the agreement, they call these things mitigation measures, and basically the ISPs can start in punishing the subscribers. For instance, you can have speed or service throttling. Basically, your overall throughput speeds will be reduced. The ISP can also introduce a redirect page. So basically, instead of seeing your home page when you go into your browser, you'll see another page, which will stay in place, meaning that you can't really surf the web at all, until you call your ISP or until you review some sort of educational content about copyright infringement. And finally, at the sixth point, basically the mitigation measures will be reinstated again and another alert will be sent to the user. But again, this goes back to the speed throttling or service throttling, that you're basically not able to access your service at the speeds that were advertised. I would imagine that they'd be quite slow, probably back to dial-up speeds, and your services might start getting cut out. It is worth noting that, at least according to this agreement, that the ISPs are not required to actually shut off or completely shut off services during any of the mitigation measures. It more likely is just that certain services will kind of be shut off and that others will probably be left on. The agreement leaves open the possibility that that ISPs might not want to shut off services that might be critical to a person, for instance, the ability to make 911 calls through a phone connection that goes through your internet connection. There was a surprising lack of criticism on the tech blogosphere about this new agreement. The main point of contention still seems to be the lack of court involvement. This basically implicates due process concerns. But most commentators seem to be okay with just about everything else. Dominic, what do you think about this new agreement? Is it a good thing? Is it a bad thing? And what should users actually be worried about?
Well, I mean, it's worth noting that it's only between the major internet providers, AT&T, Verizon, Comcast, Cablevision, Time Warner, and Cable, most of whom have some sort of high-speed internet option. I think except for Verizon and AT&T, they all are cable companies. So their existing business model already has basically sort of old-school copyright industry in the sense that they contract with television studios and cable channels that make money off of having their content protected. My concern here is sort of a due process concern in terms of, six strikes. It's all sort of it doesn't happen. It's just between you and the ISP, and if someone's misusing your account or if the ISP doesn't believe you, then there's really not any process there. They can turn off your internet, and in a lot of places there's only one ISP that you can choose from, and that's sort of a concern.
Yeah, all of this happens outside of the courtroom, and you know, you have to sort of think of the litigation process as having a neutral person, that being the judge who is overseeing the case to make sure that there's still an element of fairness. And although it's, you know, still the attorney's responsibility in the case, for instance, if you're represented by an attorney, it's his responsibility to argue those points in your favor. You don't get that here. It's all sort of done behind closed doors. And I guess the upside to this is that the ISP is not sending back any information to the recording industry regarding who you are, your identity, where you can be found. Those are all things that would, you know, probably violate some state laws, but you know, also might lead to you being sued in the state court. So it seems like they're very much removing the judicial process from this, and it's going to be less focused on litigation like the RIAA and the MPAA has done in the past. Maybe it's a bit more efficient this way. I don't really know what to make of this yet, but interestingly, you know, there wasn't a whole lot of backlash, though, from the blogosphere that tends to follow this. Another interesting point in this is that I think part of the system was based upon a bunch of research that shows when people become more aware of legal options that they have to consume content online, they're more likely to choose legal options than, say, options that might infringe somebody's copyright. So once they realize that there is a cheap and easy way to view their favorite television show online, they're less likely to torrent it. I don't know how much I buy that, but I suppose it's possible, and that's sort of what some of these notification mechanisms that are built into the agreement are based upon. It's that if we explain to people how they can go about finding legal content online, they'll be more likely to do that and more likely to utilize those options rather than infringing copyrights over torrents or other peer-to-peer networks. So do you think at all that this will be challenged in court as being, I don't know, some sort of violation of due process? This is done between private parties. It just sort of after skimming the agreement, I'm not sure what kind of standing someone might have to challenge this. Of course, you would have to be a user of one of the ISP services and have had your access either completely taken away or throttled. I suppose it's possible that you could sue under a breach of contract. That would seem to be your most likely claim. I don't know that you could really challenge this agreement, though, between the ISPs and the content owners.
Right. I mean, my concern is that since in a lot of places the ISP, a particular ISP, is the only option for internet, if there's false accusations or just someone hacking into your Wi-Fi network, even though you thought you secured it and through no fault of your own, and I mean, what do you do when your internet gets cut off? To sort of put it in more stark terms, what if after six strikes they turned off power to your house? Like, that would be, for some people, the internet, I mean, especially if someone works from home, if they lose the internet, they are very screwed. And it just doesn't seem like there's safeguards in place in this agreement to prevent, I mean, false accusations, erroneous accusations. It just seems like the content providers can just be like, ah, well, ISPs start striking people. And then after you get to six strikes, which admittedly is a lot, but there's no sort of the own there's no burden of proof on the ISP. It's just an accusation. We think you've been stealing content, and there's no way for the person to really say, no, actually I haven't, and there's no process there. It's just your word against their word, and that isn't particularly reassuring.
Yeah, that's definitely a fair point, I think. And legally right now, the challenge with thinking like that is that we have thinking that people have some sort of right to have access to the internet. As far as I know, I don't think we are quite there yet in terms of judicial doctrine, but that might be something that we visit in the future and other court opinions that are related to other things. Still, you do make some great points. You could actually craft a couple of lawsuits around reliance or damages incurred and negligence, even maybe from ISP actions that don't, if you file an appeal, say, and see, the part that's really unclear to me about the appeals process is that exactly what you noted is that there isn't the burdens aren't very clearly established. What do you do if you think that you've been falsely accused under the agreement? You file some sort of appeal, but they're probably going to ask you for either proof of it or, what makes you think that this is a false appeal, and then it just becomes a your word against the content owner's word, and you just as a consumer, I don't think you have very much leverage in that argument.
Yeah, I mean, it's very much between the ISPs and the content providers, and the consumers don't really have a voice. And I don't think there's a human right in terms of electric power either, but we don't see people get their electric power cut off.
Well, there can be in like these very odd scenarios where someone, say, is on some sort of critical life support device that isn't battery operated, and there are certain standards that apply to standard of habitability. I can't remember what the exact wording is.
Yeah, something in that variety.
Well, anyway, it's interesting to see this, and I'm also, looking forward to reading more commentary as it comes out from some of the groups that have been watching some of these things unfold. It's also worth noting that the White House heavily supported this agreement and also apparently was participating again in these backdoor discussions, trying to get the ISPs and then the content owners to agree on a solution to the problem. I think it's also worth noting that, as far as I know, and this is a little bit up in the air because there haven't been that many lawsuits about it. There isn't really any legal burdens for the ISPs to have a system like this in place. The DMCA does set forth a notice and takedown system for online service providers, and as some parts of it do implicate ISPs, other provisions that aren't related to online service providers, but actual internet access providers. But they all sort of function more similar to the way that the online service provider provisions actually apply. So it doesn't seem to me that despite this agreement that there was any legal liability that was likely to be incurred by the ISPs for not having a system like this in place to shut people off. And I think that's what makes this a little bit unusual as well. But the White House is happy with it, and so is the new IP czar, Victoria Espinel, who apparently really wanted to get this thing pushed through. And now it's here. I guess the next step in this is to see what happens with it and how and whether we start hearing reports of people, getting shut down either on the basis of false accusations or how ex parte all these proceedings actually are in between the ISPs and the content owners.
Does this apply to commercial clients of ISPs? Like, say you have a coffee shop. Are you under the six strikes? Because if so, that could be really brutal.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I don't know. I think that this mostly concerns. Well, first of all, it would have to be people that are connecting through the ISP, and most commercial connections, like the serious ones at large corporations, don't go through those ISPs. It's more of a higher level provider that you're getting because you require so much bandwidth. But for the local like shop owners and stuff, yeah, I mean, I could see if you have a business level connection through, say, Verizon or Comcast, that probably potentially affects you as well.
Yeah, I mean, if you are running a public Wi-Fi network at your coffee shop because you know it brings in more customers, and if six of those customers happen to steal content, good luck policing that in the first point. And then the ISPs come in and say, "Oh, we're going to shut down your internet." That's kind of, I mean, that
Yeah,
could go
that's
on.
interesting, and it would also open up the door to, say, wireless access point filtering, trying to stop certain protocols from being exchanged across your network. But that's, sort of beside the point, because even if there is certain types of content going back and forth or certain using certain protocols, that doesn't mean that you know exactly what the content is. It could be lawful content, it could be unlawful content, right?
Yeah.
Anyway, any last thoughts on this?
Awesome.
Okay, well, take us away to our last story.
So our second and final story this week is the Apple versus Amazon trademark dispute over the word apps or the phrase App Store. A little backstory: Apple applied for a trademark on App Store in 2008. Eventually, got through the office, the patent and trademark office, and got to what's called a notice of publication in 2010. Which is like, hey, someone wants a trademark on this. If you have a problem with us, if you have a problem with this, let us know. Microsoft filed an opposition, and that is still unresolved as of this point. But Amazon, in 2011, started using the phrase Amazon App Store to describe its own little app store for Android apps. Apple filed a preliminary injunction saying that, wait a second, App Store is our word. You can't use it without our permission. You've ignored our cease and desist letters. We're going to take you to court. So this went before the Northern District of in the Northern District of California, and basically Apple has two accusations against Amazon: that first, Amazon is infringing on its trademark, and second, that it's diluting it. The court, in a pretty clearly written 19-page ruling, so pretty straight shot, said that it's not going to give Apple a preliminary injunction. It's worth noting a preliminary injunction here is just saying that before the case is even decided, Apple said, Amazon, we want to order the we want to ask the court to order you to stop using the word App Store because it's going to cause us irreparable damage if you keep doing it while we're figuring out whether or not you can do it in the first place. Sort of a precautionary measure for rights holders to say, before we even decide, since this could harm us, and if we do turn out to win, then we sh then that we should you should stop using the mark immediately, and we won't know if we win or not until after the case. So it's better if we just play it safe. So this is just a preliminary injunction. The actual court case hasn't been decided yet, and won't be for a while. But in any case, so the court said that no, we're not going to give Apple this preliminary injunction. We're not going to let you stop having. We're not going to let you have Amazon stop using App Store. And basically, it said that it went through the infringement factors, eight of which, only five of which it really found that were important. Interestingly, it found that App Store is not a particularly strong mark. Probably the crux of the decision was that the court found that the app stores themselves were not particularly related because Amazon's were only for Android devices, where Apple's are only for iOS devices. And they also found that Amazon, because it believed in good faith, the app was generic and thus Apple's trademark to be invalid, they didn't have a malicious intent in selecting the mark. The only factors really favoring Apple were the similarity that, potentially, I mean, the App Store is the same between the two, and then the marketing channel, in that it's either on the internet, which I guess everything's on the internet nowadays. So we can talk about infringement, and then I can go into dilution. So any thoughts on this infringement holding of the preliminary injunction?
Actually, the only thing that I disagreed with you on there is the fact that this opinion was a straight shot. So back up a little bit. In our email chain this week, Ben was the one who let us know that this opinion had came out. He first was very critical of the opinion in his email, and we found some other blog posts which suggested that the opinion was a bit more straightforward. Then I actually read the opinion myself, and I have to say I kind of agree with Ben. This was a pretty poorly written opinion, and I think it's almost 18 pages, 17 or 18 pages long, and the court does very little analysis through the majority of the opinion. I'd say only about 4 pages of the opinion actually do any substantive legal analysis. Most of it is just focused on sort of recounting the parties' claims against one another. And while that's, kind of okay and acceptable in a much longer opinion that has more legal analysis, It was very distracting in this opinion. And interestingly, Eric Goldman from the Technology Law and Marketing blog thinks that this opinion was probably written by a law clerk, and a green one at that. And I think I probably agree with that as well. It was a very distracting opinion to read through. And anyway, getting to the substance of what they claimed, and I don't really, I didn't really like how the court had just so easily dismissed Amazon's claim that the Apple mark was generic. It does that in just one or two sentences, but doesn't really offer very much legal analysis. It just says, for the reasons that are argued by Apple, this court, doesn't think that the App Store mark is generic. And that was my first problem with it. Aside from that, it seems to be a pretty reasonably argued opinion in other parts of it. I'm more interested to see what the next iteration of this case is.
Yeah, in straight shot, I meant that it was sort of just very, the opinion didn't wander. It knew what it was doing. It just went straight along the path. But yeah, it is kind of, the analysis is a little lacking, and it's almost declaratory in some points. It's like, well, this is we decide that this isn't a. I mean, it seemed like the decision was made, and then the opinion almost, I don't want to say it was written to justify it, but you could, especially in some of the likelihood of confusion factors the opinion cited, you could easily go the other way. Like, one of the factors, I think, was whether or not you used the marketplace, whether you used the internet or Amazon.com as the relevant marketplace. Well, if you use Amazon.com, then that's going to kind of favor Amazon, but if you use the internet, it might favor Apple.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point too. I'm not really sure what's left then of the App Store mark after this. So the court did say that it was a fairly weak mark, and the mark itself is still going to need a showing that it has secondary meaning, which it has not. The court declined to opine on in this particular decision, but there'll probably be motions on this later at some point. I don't know that, I mean, based on what the court said, and after having read a lot of the briefs in this case, it doesn't seem like there's a very strong case for Apple here in that they have secondary meaning with the mark. Even the court notes that, that the term App Store is sort of used to describe this class of product, and it doesn't necessarily mean that it's, associated almost completely with the Apple brand. In some of the briefings, as I recall, there were even instances when Steve Jobs was quoted as describing other application online stores as app stores themselves. So it sort of has this strange suggestive or descriptiveness to it, and without the secondary meaning, I just don't think Apple's going to get very far.
I think I agree with Professor Goldman's analysis that it used to be distinctive when it first came out 4 years ago, but now it's become generic. I mean, the App Store, when it first came out, was kind of the first real thing of its kind, especially on a mobile platform. Although I guess there was the BlackBerry Marketplace back in the day, right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I still own a BlackBerry to this day. I've just never really used their App Store or whatever they call it.
Right, but I mean, it's now sort of the generic thing. I mean, what else would you call? I mean, there's the Android Marketplace, but I mean, it's basically just sort of become a generic term, I think. And the decision kind of doesn't want to say that, and so it gets itself caught in all sorts of analysis hell, because it can't really. If the opinion had just said, "Well, the mark's generic now, so good luck," then that would have been a much more straightforward opinion.
Yeah, no kidding. It would have been, I mean, that would have been pretty much dispositive on the merits right there. Sorry, your mark is pretty much generic, and we're not going to protect it. It's also worth noting that there hasn't been any admissible evidence that has been submitted by either party to the court that shows one way or another that the mark is generic or not, or whether there is secondary meaning or not. So I think at this point, what we have is the amended pleadings in the case. There was, also a counterclaim that was filed by Amazon. In the pleadings themselves, they sort of allude to evidence that they might be able to produce in the case that would suggest one way or another whether there's either secondary meaning or whether the mark is generic or not. It's hard to say what the court has actually done with the generic claim at this point. Maybe this sort of gets revived in a subsequent motion that gets filed in this case. That's possible. But aside from that, you know, it still leaves a lot for the next version of motions that come in, because, like you said, this is just about the preliminary injunction. It really doesn't get to the merits of the case quite yet, but it does suggest that the court believes that Apple really does not have a strong case.
Yeah.
I'm kind of bummed that Ben's not here. I mean, I'd love to hear his thoughts, sort of being
Yeah.
the Apple fanboy that he is. I'm sure he would have a pretty strong opinion about this.
Yeah, and especially since in our email chain he was like, this opinion is just terrible and is wrong. So, and I
Yeah.
think he was leaning more the other way though, that the marquee is protectable.
Yeah, I mean, I unfortunately, and we talked like ad nauseum about this weeks ago on a previous show where we were arguing back and forth whether the mark was generic and whether it was just descriptive without any secondary meaning. And I think that, you know, you see the same problem that the court sort of deals with in this decision. It just keeps going back and forth. Well, you know, Apple argues all of these things. Amazon argues these points, and it's so hard to make sense of it because the genericness argument is kind of similar to the distinctiveness argument that, you know, the mark is just descriptive. It's so hard to think of how else you might describe a store like this online other than App Store. I mean, you would, you know, maybe come up with a marketplace, application marketplace, app marketplace. I don't know. And that's just the problem with the mark that Apple chose to try to protect. It's just that unfortunately, it is so hard to, you know, get away from its descriptive or suggestiveness.
The other half of the opinion dealt with a dilution claim, and basically it was kind of a rather tortured analysis. In short, basically, the App Store mark isn't famous. There's no blurring, dilution by blurring, in that the court found that Amazon didn't want to confuse consumers, and because Amazon doesn't offer Apple apps, there's no tarnishment. I'm not really sure I agree with the logic there. In that, because one of the things Apple was saying was, well, Android apps, there's Android marketplaces are always known to be infested with tons of buggy. This is Apple, of course, tons of buggy viruses and apps that will say turn your phone on fire and all sorts of terrible things. So by using the word App Store and offering these terrible apps, people will be less likely to. It'll negatively impact our amazing, awesome, shiny App Store. The original one, the one that only exists.
That is the most ridiculous argument I think I have ever heard. I mean, if you own an Android device, most people know that they don't have an iPhone.
Yeah, I know, but that was the argument.
Yeah, it was. I mean, and just to be clear, a dilution by blurring, or these dilution claims, are based upon when a mark that is previously associated with one product becomes associated with another product, and then sort of the distinction between the mark and what products it's actually associated with becomes blurred. And they call that blurring, and it's actionable under trademark law, and that's it's sort of the second claim that Apple is sort of making in this case. But Apple has done such a great job about being a distinctive company, and I think it's very much sort of a choice to elect to get products from the Apple ecosystem. It feels very odd that they would argue that you know they it you have a blurring between the lines of Apple products and then products which run the Android operating system.
Yeah. Anything else on this story?
No, I think that's pretty much it. So it's a wacky opinion. If you want to see how not to write an opinion as a law clerk, or if you're a judicial intern, read this opinion. I think it's awful. I really wish that that there was a bit more control over the analysis in it, and I just wish that there was more analysis altogether. But hopefully, we'll see more of that next time around.
Yeah, again, this is just a preliminary injunction, so the case is still pending.
And that's all I got.
All right, well, signing off, I'm Dominic Rabier.
I'm David O'Brien.
And thanks for listening. You can follow us on Twitter at @TechLegal. You can subscribe to our podcast at www.technicallylegal.org. You can email us any thoughts, ideas, suggestions, comments, critiques, or otherwise at podcast@technicallylegal.org. Have a great week.